how significant a voting bloc the discontented Archie Bunker voters were. Named after the politically incorrect working-class lead in the 1970s sitcom All in the Family. Opening estimates were generally that Trump could pull 20% or so of the Republican vote, but that when the field narrowed and other candidates passed him, Trump would fade away, having soaked the campaign for all the publicity he could. At this task, he was already an overachiever. The media hostility and skepticism had garnered him huge attention. And even though most of the exposure was intended to be negative, Trump was proving his point that all publicity was valuable. He was pulling very large crowds wherever he went, and though there were hecklers and picketers, Trump supporters were very numerous and demonstrative. The level of outrage of much of the public for the wars, recession, debt, violent crime, foreign policy blunders, illegal immigration, and economic stagnation had still not registered with the complacent media. Trump's support level, as the only candidate in either party not steeped to the eyeballs in the failures of the last 20 years, had not yet been noticed by the somnambulant, flaccid media and political establishment. The Trump aberration rumbled on, gathering strength like a tornado. The Fox debate had attracted 24 million viewers, the highest total ever for such a thing. And the networks, desperate for content, started running Trump rallies live. He generally made hilarious jokes and punchy declarations and generated a great deal of mirth. They had no idea of the consequences of giving him hundreds of millions of dollars of free attention. It was designed to sink his campaign by exposure. But to the media's dismay, many Americans liked what they saw and rallied to Trump's banner. Trump did not need or buy advertising, and paid for the events themselves by selling Make America Great Again hats and T-shirts and other campaign paraphernalia. He was not only paying for his own campaign, at times he was making money from it. Inconceivably large numbers of people, including many missed by the pollsters because they had not voted or responded to polls for decades, liked his message and attended his rallies. And he was, as always, a great showman and an entertaining, if often somewhat outrageous, public speaker. The conventional wisdom, though discommoded, was tenacious. The crowds were there, but it was entertainment, and the rigorous campaign to come would banish the interloper. Trump regularly attacked the media, often singling out individual reporters or pundits as lowlifes and liars and so forth. He departed the usual labored courtesy of the election campaign and was quite dismissive of several of his opponents and debunked the entire political system as a corrupt gravy train for the insiders while the condition of the country deteriorated. "We don't win anymore," he said, referring to the United States and its recent experiences in war and trade. Each week, it became clearer that Trump had called it right, and had a much clearer judgment of the state of public opinion, from all his television, product branding, beauty contests, boxing and wrestling matches, and catering to the millions of people who gambled away a lot of their income. While he lavishly disparaged the media, he was very accessible for interviews, where he generally held his own in this early stage before policy questions became quite precise. And because he was such a phenomenon, most questions put to other candidates were about him. He took over the news, and his opponents assumed they were putting out the fire, but it kept spreading. The Trump campaign only had 5 employees, and this diminutive group determined its tactics as it went along, watching the news on Trump's airplane as they flew between campaign meetings. The media predictably took up the charge of Trump's rivals that he had no ground game, and that his campaign would implode. They eagerly anticipated Trump becoming a casualty of his allegedly self-destructive exploding ego. But Trump pointed to a small entourage and cited it as an example of business efficiency. My good friend Mark Stein, a very experienced political journalist, attended a Trump meeting near his home in New Hampshire and was in the press circle before the event. He was impressed at the absence of scurrying and officious aides. Trump was in the midst of conversation with several people when he heard himself being announced, as is traditional on such occasions, the next president of the United States, and said, "Let's get back to this when we finish. See you later." and strolled nonchalantly to center stage. He did resume the conversation later, and his manner was in all respects disarming. Instead of leaking research and gossip about rivals, Trump just trotted rumors out directly, no matter how frivolous. Thus, as time went by, to establish that Senator Lindsey Graham had given his private cell phone number to Trump, he gave it to a crowd of thousands, and he repeated spurious stories about Senator Ted Cruz's father having had an association with Lee Harvey Oswald. Cruz's father had been a Cuban communist once, but a connection to Oswald was neither believable nor relevant. He even accused Cruz of philandering and adultery, though Trump was hardly an appropriate source for such priggish comment. Trump also revived the practice from a century before of hurling personal abuse at other candidates. Standards of courtesy had descended a very long way from Ronald Reagan's 11th commandment, never speak ill of another Republican. It had even descended from when Theodore Roosevelt called William Jennings Bryan an imbecile. Donald Trump was more direct. Little Marco Rubio, senator from Florida. Lion Ted Cruz. Low-energy Jeb Bush, and ultimately, Crooked Hillary. It was undignified, of course, but there hadn't been much dignity left in presidential elections for a long time, and it was good entertainment. Much of the public considered Trump's unorthodox behavior a welcome antidote to the pomposity, platitudes, and absurd self-importance of the other candidates. The people had heard all they had to say before and were tired of it. All the other candidates had no idea how to respond. Former Texas Governor Rick Perry, who fumbled out of the Republican nomination contest 4 years earlier when he couldn't remember the name of the third government department he would abolish and said, whoops, decided he had nothing to lose with a frontal attack and denounced Trump as a mean-spirited demagogue and a cancer on conservatism. Neither Trump nor even the anti-Trump media paid much attention, and Perry soon dropped out of the race. Trump eventually made him Secretary of Energy, one of the departments Perry was going to abolish. Jeb Bush, scion of a family of gentlemen as he is, was flummoxed by Trump's tactics and finally simply said, "Donald Trump is a jerk. It felt good to get that off my chest." Such delicate reproaches were not going to turn what was a heavily running tide by late summer. Trump personally liked some of the candidates and did not mock them. Dr. Ben Carson, New Jersey's Governor Chris Christie, and Arkansas's Mike Huckabee. Scott Walker, the very respected governor of Wisconsin, who had faced down militant public service unions and the persecution of his political supporters by an egregiously partisan Milwaukee U.S. attorney, dropped out a few weeks after Perry. He had led in Iowa, where his quiet personality and strong performance in office were popular. He called himself radically normal. But Trump's personality and the strength of the Trump story, no matter how hostile the person who told it, overpowered the less assertive candidates. Walker urged others to withdraw to allow more conventional and moderate Republicans to rally around an alternative to Trump. It was only September 2015. The first primary was not until February 2016. And Trump was already attracting calls for a unitary Stop Trump candidate to prevent the grand old party from falling into the hands of the great vulgar Philistine, roughneck, and ogre, whose candidacy was greeted with howls of glee, mockery, and execration announcing a summer festival of fun and farce just 3 months before. On November 13, 2015, there were a series of terrorist incidents in Paris. A suicide bomb was detonated in the National Football Stadium, where the President of France was attending a match. And three groups of ISIS, Islamic State gunmen, attacked restaurants and cafes and opened fire in a crowded theater, killing a total of 130 people. Trump had been amenable to the admission of some refugees if they could be screened properly, but now changed course to attacking Obama's policy of admitting 110,000 refugees, which, when truthful hyperbole was applied to electioneering, he represented to a raucously cheering corn-fed Texas crowd in Beaumont as 250,000 refugees. He promised to beat the shit out of ISIS and repeated his familiar histrionics about building a wall. On December 2nd, 2015, a married Muslim couple, the husband born in the United States, and his wife, a recent legal immigrant from Pakistan, killed 14 and injured more than 30 in a shooting attack at an office holiday party in San Bernardino, California. They made no serious effort to survive the incident, and in a shootout with police, fired 81 rounds, injuring several policemen, and were killed by a fusillade of 440 rounds from many angles and a variety of weapons. It was an alleged case of Islamist self-radicalization. President Obama and Secretary Clinton declined to use the expression Islamist extremism, and Obama called it workplace violence. Trump issued a terse statement, but reserved his main reflection on the terrorist incident in California for the anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, December 7, 2015, when he spoke at Mount Pleasant, South Carolina, aboard the retired aircraft carrier Yorktown, permanently secured as a museum and war memorial. He called for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on, which he later refined to a ban on people from certain largely Islamic countries, which had become failed states or were actively hostile toward the United States. The initial reaction by the media, the Democrats, and the Republican establishment to Trump's remarks was extremely hostile. Jeb Bush, for instance, tweeted that Trump was unhinged. Trump's own small council of advisors had warned him of a potential backlash against his apparently reactionary stance. But he was cheered almost deliriously on the Yorktown, and polls shortly revealed that most Americans thought he was the only candidate who had any idea how to deal with the terrorist problem as it crept into the United States. By this time, Trump was leading most polls among Republicans and running closely with Hillary Clinton for the presidency. It was still generally assumed that when the debates became more policy-specific and the race thinned out a bit, and irritated voters felt they had got their anger out of their systems, Trump would fall behind Bush, Rubio, and Cruz, or at least one of them. But at the end of 2015, the race was almost over, though that was still not widely seen. Rather than crumpling like a burst balloon as had been anticipated, the Trump campaign's popularity was expanding and actually sucking the air out of the room for the other Republicans. The Iowa caucuses were the first test of real voters in January, and that race is generally won by whoever pulls the evangelical Christians. Trump was advised to ignore Iowa because of his marital past and raffish big city manner and financial controversies and association with gambling and contests of pulchritude between semi-naked women. But when polls showed him falling behind Ben Carson, he started barnstorming the state, questioning the intelligence of voters who would prefer Ben Carson to himself. Carson fell away, but Ted Cruz, a quasi-evangelical Christian who in his final play for the nomination 4 months later would claim in Indiana that God told me to run for president, not even Donald was going to try that one, pulled ahead, as the national media suddenly recirculated the story that Trump had no ground game. This would be far from the most imaginative of the reasons they would devise to convince their viewers and themselves as the election year unfolded that Trump could not win. At the end, they were very close. But on the night of February 1st, Cruz won Iowa after putting it about that Carson was quitting the race and that Carson's supporters should vote for him. It was a bold stroke. But when Cruz started playing hardball with Trump, he would be facing a fastball, brushback expert who threw at the cheekbones of his opponents with greater zeal and force than anyone in American national politics since the Civil War. Trump made a brief concession speech on caucus night, but claimed that Cruz had not won Iowa. He stole it, an allegation Ben Carson supported. Trump was annoyed and slightly embarrassed, but his showing in Iowa had been, all things considered, remarkably strong. Even with a movement of Protestant pastors behind him, Cruz had won only 27.6% of Iowa's caucus vote, to 24.3% for Trump and 23.1% for Rubio. Ben Carson was fourth at 9.3%, and if any of the other candidates, including the massively financed Jeb Bush, was going to make a race of it, they would have to be heard from in New Hampshire. The media tried to represent it as a stinging rebuff for Trump, but it wasn't. And in New Hampshire, he was ready and had been campaigning intermittently since 1987. 3 nights before the New Hampshire vote, Christie blasted Rubio in an all-candidates debate and said he was just a talking box who couldn't run anything. Rubio froze and repeated a canned statement about how Obama knew that he was ruining the country and was doing so deliberately. Rubio's statement had been irrelevant the first time round, but repeating it made Rubio seem like an idiot. Christie had ignored the knock of opportunity at his door 4 years before, and this was his desperation play to get into contention. He killed Rubio without resuscitating himself. Lewandowski, who was from the Granite State, and Trump's young and beautiful communications director, Hope Hicks, set out their stall carefully, and Trump called at police stations and campaigned to small groups with his customary inexhaustible energy. This was a decisive moment, as New Hampshire primaries have often been, including for John F. Kennedy, Richard Nixon, and Ronald Reagan. Trump said his team had learned a lot about the ground game in a week, and on primary day, February 9th, his campaign slapped the mouths of skeptics by taking the state 35.2% to 15.7% for Ohio Governor John Kasich, who had put his full effort there. 11.6% for Cruz, 11% for Jeb Bush, 10.5% for the mortally wounded Rubio, and 7.4% for Christie. The New Hampshire primary is usually won in both parties by the candidate who proves to be the nominee, so this was a major victory. The comfortable assertion that Trump could not break through the ceiling of 20% GOP support had been raised to 25% after Iowa and was now at 35%. Confidence that the unimaginable Trump candidacy could be resisted within the Republican Party now depended on far-fetched notions that self-destructive indiscretions would rally primary voters to a Stop Trump candidate. The thought that Trump might actually have struck a deep load of electoral anger and ambition to punish the orthodox political class was still unable to penetrate the imaginations of the commentariat. On a worst case, the conventional wisdom was sheltering in the certainty that if Trump limped through to the nomination, he would be bombed by Clinton as Goldwater had been by Johnson, with 61% of the vote to 38.5% in 1964, and as McGovern was by Nixon by a similar margin in 1972, which in the present electorate would be a plurality of 30 million votes. Since a Trump victory was unthinkable to the knowledgeable, no one thought about it aloud, except Newt Gingrich, Ann Coulter, and Trump's influential supporters on the talk radio circuit, who had tens of millions of followers, such as Rush Limbaugh, Laura Ingraham, and Sean Hannity. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky said, as reported by the New York Times and not denied, that if Trump were nominated, we'll drop him like a hot rock and run the Senate campaign separately from the presidential election. The campaign moved to the South, starting with South Carolina on February 20th. Again, in the debate before the primary, it was widely thought that Trump had gone too far. When Jeb Bush had defended his brother, the ex-president, and said that he was securing the country while Trump was putting on a down-market reality television show, Trump reminded the audience that the World Trade Center towers had been brought down by suicide skyjackers while George W. was the president. Trump had claimed that Bush lied over Saddam's possession of weapons of mass destruction, but under heavy questioning from the media, retreated to the assertion that he should not have been so confident that Saddam did have such weapons. The live audience booed, but Trump, as always, was unrepentant and compounded this controversy by getting into an imbroglio with the Pope, who does not have a large number of co-religionists in South Carolina. Flying back from Mexico to Rome, the Pope had said, in evident reference to Trump's promise to build a wall on the border with Mexico, that this was not Christian. Trump replied that the Vatican had massive walls, and that if the Vatican is attacked by ISIS, which everyone knows is its ultimate trophy, I can promise you that the Pope would have only wished and prayed that Donald Trump would have been president. Trump won the exchange, and the Pope's remarks were gratuitous, but Trump didn't need more controversy. The next day, he told a story that is generally believed not to be true, though it has been about for many years, that General John J. Pershing, while suppressing a Muslim revolt in the Philippines in the early 20th century, ordered the execution of 50 Muslim rebels. Had the firing squad's bullets dipped in pig's blood, affronting Muslim sensibilities, spared one of the men sentenced to death and told him to tell his people what had happened. This was a story that circulated in military schools, such as the one Trump attended in New York. Trump won the South Carolina primary easily, with 32.5% of the vote. Rubio, buoyed by the endorsement of the popular governor of South Carolina, Nikki Haley, eased in ahead of Cruz, 22.5% to 22.3%, with Kasich, Carson, and Bush all between 7 and 8%. Bush suspended his campaign that night. The Bush era in the Republican Party, a coincidence arising from Reagan having made George H.W. Bush vice president, was over. With Jeb, in many ways a more appealing candidate than family members that preceded him, the family's luck ran out. He hit a buzzsaw with Trump, and the country considered the Bushes tainted by the unprecedented and infuriating decline of America, which seemed to have fallen overnight from being the world's sole superpower to being a country mired in recession, endless war, and cultural self-doubt. It was clear that, unlike the other candidates who could raise themselves up to some extent in states where they could concentrate time and resources, Trump was going to pull a large number of voters everywhere in the country. It was the last chance to put up a Stop Trump candidate, and it was only February. Cruz, a Texan, had been counting on South Carolina and a big cleanup in the following Southern primaries. This was obviously not going to happen, and nor was there an obvious principal alternative to Trump. Rubio, if he had not been so shamefully demolished by the departing Christie, who soon dropped out and endorsed Trump, might have been able to do it, but the Trump steamroller seemed unstoppable. The primaries now came down swiftly, and the vote percentages of Trump, Cruz, Rubio, and Kasich are repeated in that order after each state. Alabama, 43, 21, 19, 9. Arkansas, 33, 30.5, 25, 4. Georgia, 39, 23.6, 24.4, 6. Massachusetts, 49, 10, 18, 18. Tennessee, 39, 25, 21, 5. Vermont, 35, 32, 17, 9. Virginia, 33, 10, 19, 30. The Massachusetts result was especially astounding. The Republicans had no chance of winning the state in a presidential election. Reagan, in 1984, was the only Republican to do so since Eisenhower in 1956. And even the Republicans are very liberal. But Trump romped over his rivals. It was clear from these primaries that Trump had the strongest and least regional base of Republican support, which meant that even if every other candidate dropped out, leaving only one anti-Trump stalwart, Trump still had a very good chance of winning. All the ridicule of the media, the howls of outrage and mockery of the sophisticates and of the sensitive, the bunk about ground games, none of it counted for anything. The Republican field wasn't weak. Bush, Kasich, Christie, and Huckabee all were or had been popular and successful governors. Cruz and Rubio and Rand Paul were articulate and well-publicized senators, but they were instantly passé. They were all identified with the decrepit failure of war, recession, stagnation, debt, and international embarrassment and humiliation of the past 20 years. Trump was the only contender who wasn't, and who understood the populist groundswell that his competitors missed, and he was now unstoppable among the Republicans. It still never seemed to dawn on anyone that he might not be any pushover for Hillary Clinton either, and she had her hands full dealing with a revolt from the left, led by the independent Democratic senator from Vermont, who had been elected to the Senate as a socialist, Bernie Sanders. Just before the Illinois primary on March 15th, there were clashes with anti-Trump protesters, and at a Trump rally in Ohio the next day, an unarmed but angry and belligerent man tried to storm Trump's platform at the airport. Trump's instinct was not to duck or run, but to clench his fists and turn to face the commotion. Security removed the man without serious incident, and when Trump resumed his speech, he joked with his audience, "I was ready for him, but it's much easier if the cops do it." Trump dealt with a lot of hecklers, and neither he nor his followers had much toleration of them. Though it must be said, the interlopers never showed any disposition to witty repartee. This was not a British election meeting, and these were not effete audiences. Donald Trump was speaking to his followers, a great many of whom believed that he was the first candidate for the nation's highest office since Reagan, with the possible exception of Bill Clinton at his best, who cared a rap for them or spoke their language. Trump had lots of private as well as official security and would urge them to remove disorderly or disruptive people. "Get them out of here." Or, "In the good old days, this didn't happen because of the rough treatment they got." Or, "I'd like to punch him in the face or even knock the crap out of him." The best response was, "Try not to hurt him. If you do, I'll defend you in court." It was a bit crude, but Trump genuinely identified with the general feeling of being angry at what had happened to the country, impatient for a change of approach, and irritated by attempts to prevent him from speaking to large crowds of supporters. He was accused of inciting violence, but that was an unjust rap. He refused, on behalf of his evidently very large following, to be intimidated by physical threats or vocal interruptions. When asked if he had encouraged violence at his rallies, Trump replied, "I truly hope not. We have some protesters who are bad dudes." That was a fair summary, and was later confirmed with revelations that Democratic operatives had paid for bad dudes to disrupt Trump events, but did not spare him from the charge by his now fearful, rather than merely contemptuous enemies, that he, and not those who came to prevent him from speaking or being heard, was inciting violence. Kasich won his home state of Ohio in the primary of March 15th, 47% to 36% for Trump and 13% for Cruz. This was an achievement, but Kasich was a successful governor who had been reelected by more than a million votes, and he only beat Trump by 220,000 votes, and gave an eccentric victory speech in which he urged people to take a widow to dinner and embrace a stranger in the mall. Advice, which if followed, would have led to a startling increase in sexual assault charges across the state. On the same day, in Florida, in a winner-take-all primary, Trump bombed Rubio out of the race in his home state 47% to 27%, with 17% for Cruz and 7% for Kasich. Cruz was finally the last viable man standing against Trump when they got to Wisconsin on April 5th, though Kasich remained in the race, hoping to present himself as the ultimate anti-Trump Republican in a long-shot bid to consolidate the anti-Trump vote, both in the remaining primaries and possibly at the Republican convention. Cruz won Wisconsin by 48% to Trump's 35% to 14% for Kasich. Cruz had some success rounding up spare delegates where states had not elected pledged delegates and outsmarted the local Trump organizations in North Dakota and Colorado. But Trump caught on quickly, and on April 19th in New York, after playing up Cruz's earlier derision of New York values, hammered the Texans 60% to 17% and 23% for Kasich, and took 89 of 96 delegates. It seemed that there might still be a very slender chance to deny Trump a majority on the first ballot, keep him out until the pledged delegates were free to vote as they wished, and get the party grandees, such as they were, to broker something, as in olden times, either for Kasich or for some other establishment-favored candidate. It was a madly improbable idea, but it was the only hope the never-Trumpers had before the showdown in the general election, where the conventional wisdom, shaking but still afloat, held Clinton to be unbeatable, despite the desperate bruising she was taking from the preposterous Sanders. The Vermont senator had worked and lived in a Stalinist kibbutz even after the 20th Communist Party Congress had denounced Stalin. He had even taken his honeymoon in Khrushchev's Moscow. If Trump was a change, Sanders was an off-the-wall democratic Marxist, representing the sylvan little state of Vermont with his heavy Brooklyn accent. The presidential race was becoming steadily more surreal, with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump standing in the wide center in policy terms, between the far-leftist Sanders and the gun-toting, Bible-thumping Texan prosecutor Cruz, who was pitching his campaign to the corn cobbers and the wool hats. The Cruz dream died in Indiana on May 3rd. Trump carried the state 53% to 37% for Cruz and 7% for Kasich. Cruz said he had left everything he had on the field in Indiana, having in a desperate gambit to swing more voters his way, announced Carly Fiorina, former CEO of Hewlett-Packard and former U.S. Senate candidate from California, but fatally much more loved by the conservative establishment than by conservative voters, as his running mate. He and Kasich suspended their campaigns. They didn't officially withdraw in order to receive public funding for campaign expenses. Hillary Clinton eventually retained control of the Democrats, relying on ex officio delegates, the same group that had taken the nomination from her 8 years before when she ran even with Barack Obama in the primaries. She did defeat Sanders in the primaries by 16.9 million to 13.2 million votes, but more than half her delegate lead was provided by unelected superdelegates. As the nominating process in both parties lumbered to its weary end, there were plenty of disturbing statistics for those who confidently assumed that the Clintons would be moving back into the White House. A strong Republican candidate, an Eisenhower, a Nixon in 1972, or a Reagan, can take Pennsylvania in a presidential election. But the primary results in that state generally indicate a substantially larger number of Democrats than Republicans. In the primaries on April 26, 2016, the Republicans got almost 49% of the total vote, although there was a ding-dong battle between Clinton and Sanders on the Democratic side. Trump won the Republican primary 57% to 22% for Cruz and 19% for Kasich. And there appeared to be indications that he was pulling significant numbers of blue-collar Democrats, who had been dismissed in that state 8 years before by Obama as preoccupied with guns and religion. Noteworthy was that significant numbers of Trump supporters in Pennsylvania and elsewhere were voting for the first time in some years. In Indiana on May 3rd, while it is generally a 55% or so Republican state, Trump took 53% of the Republican vote, which amounted to 92% of the entire number of Democratic votes in a hotly contested battle between Clinton and Sanders, which Clinton won narrowly in the state. Trump was getting stronger rather than weaker as the campaign progressed. Instead of being worn down by the febrile animosity of the sophisticated media, he was pulling a steadily greater wave of people who were more pleased than offended by his roundhouse attacks on the bipartisan misgovernment of the recent past, always delivered with panache and large dollops of hyperbole, truthful and otherwise. Hillary was still the favorite, but it was no time for the complacency still unctuously exuded by the Republican never-Trumpers and their Democratic analogs. Comfortable America took its summer holiday feigning serene confidence, but nagged by a concern that matters were getting out of hand. They were. Almost no respectable opinion could yet imagine that Donald Trump, of all people, might actually be on his way to the White House as chief occupant. It was too unthinkable. But to take a phrase from segregationist Dixiecrat candidate George C. Wallace in 1968, Trump had shaken the governing elites of the country by their eye teeth, and it was far from over. In a year that was supposed to produce a Bush-Clinton rematch, the American political class was in shambles. Chapter 7. The Republican Nominee. As the dust settled and Trump prepared for the convention, the ambiance within Republican ranks was far from conciliatory. Many within the Republican establishment, including former presidents George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush, former Governor Jeb Bush, former presidential candidate Mitt Romney and Ohio Governor John Kasich, let it be known that they would not be supporting Trump, and House Speaker Paul Ryan said he was not ready to support the apparent nominee. Trump replied that he might remove Ryan as chairman of the Republican convention. On June 2nd, however, Ryan said he would vote for Trump, and he was confirmed as convention chairman. There was squabbling within the campaign itself, and Trump fired Lewandowski and replaced him with Paul Manafort, a more seasoned political professional, whose chief job was to make sure Trump had a sufficient number of committed delegates to stave off attempts by anti-Trump agitators to release delegates from their pledges and block Trump from getting the nomination. Senate leader Mitch McConnell, Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama, and former presidential and vice presidential candidate Robert Dole, and several governors and former governors, including Rick Perry of Texas, who had denounced Trump as a toxic demagogue before quitting the race, endorsed Trump. McConnell said that the wishes of the voters in the primaries had to be respected. On June 12th, a Muslim gunman born in the United States killed 49 people and himself in a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida. Trump repeated his demands for restriction of Muslim immigration, which was not relevant to the facts of the tragedy, and did so in part to argue that he and America were tolerant of homosexuals in a way that Muslim radicals were not. He also implied that Obama was too friendly with America's enemies. The media and the left took this badly, accusing Trump of picking on one minority group while trying to appease another, and not understanding the alleged nuanced diplomacy of Obama. The rising contumely in the media got worse when Trump accused the judge in a class action suit against Trump University of being biased because of his Latin American heritage. The judge had Hispanic parents, was born in Indiana, and was a member of various Hispanic legal organizations, including the San Diego La Raza Lawyers Association. And Trump undoubtedly believed he was merely telling the blunt truth. But it was at least a provocative thing to say. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina went too far when he said Trump's remarks were the most un-American thing from a politician since Joe McCarthy. If anybody was looking for an off-ramp, this was probably it. Ryan denounced Trump's words as absolutely unacceptable, the textbook definition of a racist comment. This was overstating it, too, and Ryan did not retract his support of the candidate, but Trump was being perverse in aggravating the sore regions of his party. Trump stated that he refused to be politically correct, and that his whole interest was to make America great again, which could not be achieved with more political correctness. He said that his wife, sitting beside him in the back of a massively armored car with windows an inch thick and a huge security unit holding back thousands of people outside the Trump Tower, asked him, "Are you sure that this is what you want for the rest of your life?" Of course it was. On July 5th, the FBI director, James B. Comey, held a press conference to announce that after a criminal investigation of a year into Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server while she was Secretary of State, an investigation that included looking into the destruction of evidence, the erasure of 33,000 emails, many of which were government property and had been subpoenaed by Congress, that he would not recommend a prosecution. The Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, had inadvisedly met on an official aircraft on the tarmac at Phoenix Airport with former President Bill Clinton on June 29th, and there were loud calls for her recusal from the Clinton email investigation. She said she would abide by the advice of the FBI director. It later came to light that she had asked, and Comey had agreed, that the investigation should be called the Clinton Matter rather than an investigation. It also later emerged that Comey had written a draft exculpation of Mrs. Clinton 6 weeks before he interviewed her or other key witnesses, including close aides Cheryl Mills, Heather Samuelson, or Huma Abedin. Moreover, there was some evidence that Lynch knew beforehand that Comey would not recommend charges against Hillary. So her agreeing to abide by Comey's advice was not much of a concession to the impartial administration of justice. At his press conference on July 5th, Comey explained in detail that Clinton's conduct and that of some of her entourage had been extremely careless, but concluded that no reasonable prosecutor would bring such a case. He did not elaborate. It eventually emerged that a rabid Clinton supporter in the counterintelligence service of the FBI, Peter Strzok, had changed grossly negligent, a crime, to extremely careless. The same FBI official would later be exposed as a prominent figure in an anti-Trump movement within the federal bureaucracy in late 2017. 2 days after his press conference, Comey was questioned closely by the Republican-led House Judiciary Committee and acknowledged that a number of Mrs. Clinton's utterances on the subject of her emails, some of them to FBI investigators, had been inaccurate. He did not speculate on whether her statements had been honestly mistaken or deliberately untruthful. This was the first time that the FBI had revealed the results of an investigation rather than handing its recommendation discreetly to the Justice Department, and it was never explained why Lynch had invited Comey to do so, rather than, after her recusal, giving it to the Deputy Attorney General, Sally Yates. This is where this matter lay until October 26th, though there were audible rumblings of discontent that his decision was improper and suspect. Hillary Clinton claimed it was a complete vindication, though she acknowledged that she had short-circuited the truth. The Republican convention in Cleveland opened on July 16th and came right after a terrible terrorist incident on the Promenade des Anglais in Nice, France, on Bastille Day, July 14th, that killed 86 people, and the murder of 8 policemen and wounding of 9 in Dallas and Baton Rouge by black militants on July 7th and 17th. The convention was supposed to be an informal Trump celebration, but was sobered by the theme of American decline under the Obama administration, marred by the boycotts and rebellions of anti-Trump Republicans, including that of Governor Kasich, who refused to attend a convention held in his own state, and by the amateurism and stupidity of a speechwriter giving the poised, beautiful, and popular Melania Trump a speech that plagiarized directly from a speech by Michelle Obama, making Mrs. Trump a blameless victim of the inadequacies of her husband's campaign staff. Trump revealed the identity of his vice presidential choice, Governor Mike Pence of Indiana, who was well received, though CNN, generally known as the Clinton News Network throughout the campaign because of its relentless partiality, falsely claimed that Trump had changed his mind and wanted to dump Pence. The other alleged contenders had been New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, but Christie had too much political baggage, as would become apparent, and Gingrich was better suited to commenting on Trump than serving under him, though his wife Callista became Trump's United States Ambassador to the Holy See. The convention was generally rather rancorous, with the predictable fierce attacks on the Clintons, especially on their financial integrity and her past appeasement of Islam, including her refusal to utter the words Islamist extremism and her alleged negligence in the killing of the U.S. ambassador and 3 other Americans during a terrorist attack in Benghazi, Libya in 2012. The convention also gave lots of airtime to people whose family members had been murdered by illegal immigrants, an issue that particularly agitated Trump, but also that was certain to produce negative comment from the liberal media. Trump, however, refused to be cowed by media criticism and had already written the media off as an overt enemy of his campaign. Former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani gave an address that would have led a foreign visitor to believe that no one in the country could set foot outside their homes at night, or in many places even during the day, without fear of physical assault. It was one thing to make America great, but something different to try to incite hysteria about the state of public security. An official of the National Rifle Association explained how Hillary Clinton would take away everyone's firearms. Governor Christie conducted an in absentia mock trial of Hillary Clinton and worked the crowd up chanting, "Lock her up" and "Guilty." There was a primetime film called Hillary the Horrible. It was already clear that the Democrats were going to scorch Trump as a racist, sexist, crook, and idiot, even if this were the only subject where the Clintons, Obama, and Sanders could agree. Trump, in the Irish football expression, was getting his retaliation in first. It was going to be an epic mudslinging match, and in Pentagonese, both candidates were target-rich environments. Trump emulated the law and order theme Richard Nixon emphasized at the 1968 GOP convention, where he drew huge applause for such lines as, "No one will use the American flag for a doormat in this country or any other while I am the president." In their Trump biography, Washington Post's Michael Cranish and Mark Fisher wrote the Republican convention presented TV viewers with a vision of a country in deep trouble, unsafe, weak, governed by rigged systems and by people who had dishonest, even evil intentions. Speakers described a country that had lost respect abroad and hope at home, a country nearly at the mercy of terrorists. It was a gloomy picture of a nation in decline, a society that had lost its identity. Naturally, this was not a theme to bring the patriotic Republicans at the convention to their feet cheering. But interspersed with vehement expressions of hostility toward Hillary, it armed the faithful with a grim sense of what they were fighting against. One delegate proposed that Hillary be hanged on a gallows without further discussion, and another suggested a firing squad instead. Hillary Clinton put out a widely played television advertisement in the middle of the Republican convention, accusing Trump of having no self-discipline, no self-control, no sense of history, no understanding of the limits of the kind of power that any president should impose upon himself. It was the scolding of a schoolmarm. The country was uncomfortable with both candidates, but Trump had a huge and ardent following. Hillary was Bill's wronged wife, the only woman in the race, and not Trump. But few could regard her with enthusiasm. It was more a sense of resignation that she was next in line for the Democrats, no matter how unlikable or ethically tainted she might be. The Cleveland Republican Convention had a number of memorably odd moments. One was when runner-up Ted Cruz spoke and did not mention the nominee, urging Republicans to vote your conscience. A pretty corny and unsportsmanlike exhortation, which drew tremendous booing and catcalls. Then Donald Trump himself walked on stage to waves of applause. It wasn't party unity, but it wasn't a staged and forced exercise in Clintonian non-spontaneity either. Trump wound it up with a 76-minute harangue to a television audience of 35 million, rather more than Mitt Romney had reached 4 years before. He spoke from a teleprompter to be more systematic and structured than he generally was in his frequently hilarious but often rather syncopated and discursive addresses he gave to big crowds on the hustings. He fear-mongered and lamented for 15 minutes before easing into attacks on his opponent. This set the crowd on fire with chants of lock her up and less polite calls. The candidate didn't sign on with the chants and instead raised his hand and said, "Let's defeat her in November." This comparatively statesmanlike stance was varied somewhat with the assertion that Hillary Clinton's legacy would be death, destruction, terrorism, and weakness. He promised to win against the woman responsible for terrible, terrible crimes. But he also invited Silicon Valley billionaire Peter Thiel to be the first openly gay man to address a GOP convention, and went out of his way to promise that, as president, he would protect the LGBTQ community. And when this drew applause, he paused to thank the convention for approving sentiments favorable to gays. Despite the smears of homophobia, Donald Trump was the most pro-gay GOP presidential nominee in American history, and one who managed that feat while also being a sincere defender of religious liberty, with overwhelming support among white evangelical voters. He relied implicitly on his claimed status as an efficient and bold businessman to get the quick resolutions he promised for difficult problems, like crime and drug abuse. Hit all his usual hot buttons again, and ended, "I'm your voice, believe me." He didn't get a huge bounce from his convention, and the country that wasn't already won over by him would take some persuading. But it wasn't as disorderly a convention as it could have been, given the Republican establishment's disdain for its own nominee. There would be no traditional gentlemanly wait for the other side's convention, and Trump launched his formal assault on the White House at once. It was generally still assumed Hillary Clinton would win safely enough, but there was not now a consensus that it would be a romp. Trump personally was confident. After the distance he had covered against all odds, he had some reason to be. Trump brought Kellyanne Conway, an experienced pollster and political strategist, on board on July 1st, and in August she replaced Manafort as campaign manager, as he had proved contentious, and there were media attacks on his former position as an advisor to pro-Russian President Viktor Yanukovych of Ukraine. On the same day as Ms. Conway's elevation, Trump brought in the head of Breitbart, a lively but somewhat conspiratorialist news service, Steve Bannon, as chief executive of the campaign. Bannon is an interesting intellectual Catholic with a good background in the Navy, finance, and filmmaking, but also cantankerous and cranky. And as journalist James Dellingpole noted, the most terrifying boss you could ever have. He's short-tempered, and when he roasts you, he's very foul-mouthed. But he is a genius as well, a political visionary. Trump was impressed by Kellyanne Conway, and she brought a renewed sense of direction, discipline, and focus to the campaign, though inevitably there were conflicts with so many powerful personalities working together. Conway was the first female campaign manager of a winning presidential bid, continuing Trump's history of promoting talented women in largely male-dominated fields. But neither she nor he got credit for that, such was the media hostility against them. In late summer, Clinton was leading in all the polls, but only by between 1% and 7%. Trump's achievement, whatever happened next, was amazing. In the entire history of the country, the only other major party nominee for the presidency who had never held a public office, even an unelected one, or a senior military position, was Wendell L. Willkie, lawyer, utilities executive, and public intellectual, who ran a strong but unsuccessful campaign against Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1940. Trump was also the wealthiest presidential nominee ever, and the oldest person ever nominated for president by a major party for a first term. Almost all the media had guffawed in uproarious disbelief at every stage of Trump's candidacy, and assumed, right to the end, that it had been a brand-building move to enable him to sell more neckties, mineral water, or deodorant, and that he had just struck it lucky to do as well as he did. It also propagated the myth that all Trump's followers were blue-collar reactionaries, when it was clear from the huge vote he pulled in many Republican primaries, including Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, New York, and Florida, that he was taking a big chunk of the middle class and a surprising number of non-whites of all ethnicities. That he offended the comfortable left as a reactionary did not mean that he really was a reactionary, only that he was politically incorrect and prepared to say how catastrophically misgoverned the United States had been for the last 20 years. He stuck to his lines that he was in favor of immigration but not illegal immigration, and in favor of health care for everyone, but not on a coercive and dishonest basis such as Obama had put across, as in famously false promises that patients could keep their doctors and that their premiums wouldn't go up. Trump was in favor of charter schools because, like most parents in the country, though his own children had gone to private schools, he held teachers' unions responsible for the net decline of the IQ of the American public in the last generation, a shockingly underreported story. He was in favor of foreign trade, but not of immense trade and current account imbalances that resulted in American unemployment. Trump was concerned with the environment, but opposed to throwing millions of people out of work and paying billions of dollars to foreign governments because of unproved theories of global warming and how to combat it. Much of the country, as it turned out, considered these policies he opposed to be, in Napoleon's phrase, lies agreed upon. And although he often put it a bit simplistically, he favored a sensible definition of the national interest and the retention or development of the level of military strength necessary and sufficient to protect that interest, while pursuing neither the military adventurism of George W. Bush nor the pacifistic defeatism of Barack Obama. He was not an isolationist and favored alliances, but not alliances where allies gave the instructions and Americans did the work and paid the bills. To his visceral opponents, this was knuckle-dragging demagogy. To tens of millions of others, annoyed and in many cases unnerved by financial insecurity and national embarrassment, it was plain-spoken truth. So sudden and profound had been the disintegration of the liberal, democratic, and look-alike Republican consensus, the commentariat embarked almost unanimously aboard the good ship Clinton, not realizing it was already sinking. Distinguished conservative opinion leaders like George Will, Bret Stephens, David Frum, and David Brooks, almost every writer at National Review, The Weekly Standard, and Commentary, and Bush-inclined neoconservatives sitting in right-leaning think tanks denounced Trump as a brainless, vulgar, dangerous charlatan and barbarian. It was an uncontrollable reflex, whose causes could be understood and explained up to a point, but which became the source of a barrage of mindless and irrational fulminations. With a few exceptions, this obloquy from the highbrow right continued even after Trump's policy successes cemented his as the most successful first year for a conservative president since Reagan, if not Eisenhower. In a moment of truth, Bill Kristol acknowledged his loathing for Trump is bringing out my inner liberal. Trump greeted it all with amusement. He knew that these people controlled no votes, influenced few, and were talking to themselves, and that it would be a valuable gift to run against the Washington and New York and Los Angeles media and entertainment communities that had not gotten anything right for decades. Self-important, polysyllabic pundits were precisely the sort of people who would be ignored and despised by the great unwashed body of America of Jack Kerouac. "Whither goest thou, America, in thy shiny car in the night?" Kerouac asked in his On the Road. The answer in 2016 was not necessarily to Hillary Clinton. The conservative columnist's antics reinforced Clintonian overconfidence, as did the cloying deference of Hollywood stars. The country might be able to take all the opinionated airheads of the movies on the big or little screen, but they had no more interest in what Beyonce or George Clooney or Meryl Streep thought about politics than they wished baseball stars to remove their appendix or supermodels to extract their wisdom teeth. Donald Trump was the champion of transforming celebrity into political influence, and he dismissed Clinton's Hollywood entourage as idiots and posers. Many were. On July 23rd, just before the opening of the Democratic Convention, WikiLeaks released a large number of Democratic National Committee emails that showed that the party executive was strongly in favor of Clinton over Sanders and had violated obligations of neutrality. Emails of the party chairman Debbie Wasserman Schultz revealed the DNC had tried to rig the convention, and Wasserman Schultz, amid great controversy, was obliged to resign and was booed from the podium as she did so. At a lively press conference from his Doral golf course on July 27th, Donald Trump joked, "Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing." The humorless and befuddled media, unable to take a joke, concluded that Trump had incited treason. The Democratic Convention was in Philadelphia from July 25th to 28th, and was a full return broadside of ad hominem fire at the Republican nominee, as well as a celebration of the Bill Clinton and Obama years, as if they had not been interrupted by the George W. Bush interregnum and had been an uninterrupted, four-term coruscation of good government and unchallengeable progress. Trump was portrayed as a racist, a sexist, an inciter of violence, a crooked businessman, totally unstatesmanlike, an ignoramus, and a disruptive interloper in the inexorable progress of liberal democratic America, by a litany of speakers from a host of former and inspiring incumbents that included both Clintons, both Obamas, Vice President Joe Biden, and Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, who between them had spent or were about to be nominated to spend the formidable total of 52 years in the official residences of the president and vice president. At one point during the convention, then-First Lady Michelle Obama gave a stirring speech about the merits of taking the high road in politics, including the much-touted phrase, "When they go low, we go high." Unless Hillary Clinton had thought Mrs. Obama was referring to budgetary expenditures on attack ads, she was not inspired by the speech. The Clinton election strategy was unprecedented in two relevant respects. It shattered all records for most money spent by a political campaign on attack ads, $400 million, which consisted of the highest proportion of personal attack ads, more than 60%, described in a study on campaign spending published by the Westland Media Project as devoid of policy discussion. All told, Clinton and her allies spent a staggering $250 million on personal attacks, 10 times more than Trump, who not only spent less but focused far more on policy, 70% of his ads. Given this obscene $250 million smear job, it is miraculous that Trump's approval rating is as high as it is. It is also amazing and alarming that the media so uniformly accepted that Mrs. Clinton's campaign was taking the high road and that Trump was taking the low road when he responded to her attacks. Personal attacks might make for a perfectly good partisan argument up to a point. But in the case of the Clinton campaign, it was not accompanied by any policy program that was emphasized enough for the voters to notice it. Obama's audacious and hopeful promise to bring about change we can believe in